In Columbus, Ohio, where I teach, there is a recovery center there that is owned and sponsored by Parkside. So they are very deeply involved in this. Well, John Keller is the chief clinical officer for Parkside Services, and he has another book out called Ministering to Alcoholics, and is a standard guide to dealing in a ministerial way with people who are suffering from chemical dependency. And this book is a very interesting book, and I highly recommend it to you. So let me pass it out among you. You can just look at it. And it is in the bookstore. The copies are in. They came in yesterday. So take a look at that, and I think you will find it a very helpful resource, whether you yourself suffer from this disease or have anyone in your family, people who are close to you suffering from this disease. I think all people can benefit.
Well, it doesn't have to be alcoholism. It can be any kind of a disease. I felt that that's how I got well from nephritis. Mm-hmm. It's been a miraculous recovery since the history of nephritis.
Now look at that. I do know that the dynamics, the family dynamics, in families where one member of the family is chronically ill are very much the same kind of dynamics as in a family where one of the members of the family or several members of the family suffer from the disease of chemical dependency or alcoholism. And I remember advising a student of mine whose father was suffering from multiple sclerosis. The more I began to hear about the dynamics of that family, what was going on, I recommended very much that he, if no one else in the family would go, at least he go to an Al-Anon meeting and become deeply involved in the Al-Anon program, because that was the only way that he could learn to get a better emotional, psychological, spiritual health to deal with a dysfunctional family situation because of that chronic illness. So yeah, I think it is widely applicable. And I hope that I'm able this morning to let you understand my assumption that ultimately this recovery program is helpful for everybody and anybody. let's begin. My name is Don Luck. If you don't know who I am, I teach systematic theology at Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Columbus, Ohio. I do not teach courses on chemical dependency. I'm not a chemical dependency counselor. I'm not an expert. But I have a deep concern about this disease, and I have been a member of the Task Force on Chemical Dependency for the Ohio Synod of the LCA, and also the Task Force of the seminary itself. And I've shared a little bit about the program that Trinity Lutheran Seminary has now initiated. It goes into place this coming fall. It's a multifaceted program in which we have a very open policy about chemical dependency and how we view it and how we respond to it and what persons in our community can expect from the rest of the community if they indeed suffer from this disease. I also spent some time talking about the dynamics of chemical dependency in a very brief sort of way and describing it indeed as a disease. It is a disease that is physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual. The physical dimension, of course, is the most significant element of it, because persons who are chemically dependent, particularly focusing now on those who are alcoholic, have what some call an allergic reaction to alcohol. That is, they respond to alcohol differently than most people, and they have a physical base to the disease. That physical base is met when people withdraw from the use of alcohol or any other mind or mood-altering substance. So that is the recovery at that point. But that is only one dimension of the recovery, and indeed the total recovery is dependent upon the other facets of the disease, namely the emotional, psychological, and spiritual facets. What does that mean? Well, first of all, chemical dependency is an emotional disease. It operates at the level of human feelings. It's a way that people come to grips with negative feelings. And we all have to deal with negative feelings. And we all tend to deal with negative feelings very often in somewhat the same way. These negative feelings can be of all sorts. We have negative feelings in terms of our interacting with other people. We have negative feelings in terms of how we see ourselves. We have feelings of inadequacy. We have feelings of self-criticism or being criticized from without. We feel put down or discounted. We have feelings of anger. We have feelings of loneliness. We have feelings of guilt. We have all these negative feelings. The question is, what do we do with these feelings? How do we handle these feelings? We usually tend to handle them in an unhealthy way. That's all of us, whether we're chemically dependent or not. But there's a temptation to deal with negative feelings in an unhealthy way. Often we suppress them, we deny them, we make believe they're not there. What? Me angry? Me? I'm not angry. We're acting out in certain ways that indicate we're getting the message across to the other person. We're really very angry, but we don't want to deal with it directly. We don't want to be very open about it. We find it difficult to deal with these sorts of negative feelings. How do we deal with feelings of guilt? How do we deal with feelings of inadequacy? We don't measure up. We don't measure up to the standards of other people. We don't measure up to our own standards. How do we deal with that? So one of the ways we deal with it is to deny it, is to suppress the feeling, to push it down. But actually, the feelings don't go away. They just become subterranean, and they keep bubbling around. And we find that we have to keep dealing with them because they keep nagging us. So what happens in chemical dependency, part of the dynamics of chemical dependency is that the mood-altering character of alcohol or other drugs, like prescription drugs that are given to you by the doctor in good faith, become a way of escaping from those negative feelings. Because as long as you're under the influence of the drug, you don't feel the negative feelings. And hence, that's why there is an emotional and psychological dimension, a dimension that deals with feelings, and a dimension that deals psychologically with one's sense of oneself and a sense of connection to other people. So one pattern is to deny it. Another then is to do something to make us feel good about ourselves. We take drugs or else we do good deeds for people. There's a kind of a strange addiction that way. We're always running around being very kind and nice to other people because we really like to get the reward of feeling very, very good about ourselves. So when you feel badly about yourself, quick, do something. We also are addicted to work. It's a favorite addictive pattern in the United States, one that has great social approval. You don't feel good about yourself? Just work hard, and what will happen? What happens when you work hard?
Sense of accomplishment.
Yeah, you feel accomplishment?
And you forget about it.
You forget about it?
You're doing well, too.
Support.
Yeah, other people say, oh, yeah. This person is so wonderful, they're always so hardworking, they take their work home with them, they even come in on the weekends to the office. I mean, they're always, yeah, and you're always feeling good, and you're always having something in common. That's how you can handle your negative feelings. You become addicted to work, or you become addicted to religion, unhealthy religion. You become addicted to all sorts of things. The point is the pattern of addiction, looking to something outside of yourself to make you feel good about yourself and to handle negative feelings. So that's another way of dealing with them. We deny them, or we compensate for them, or else we project them and blame other people. The reason I'm feeling negative is because look at everything that's happening to me. The boss doesn't understand me. I have a nagging spouse. I have unruly children. I have impossible parents. I have absolutely unneighborly neighbors. I just have a tough time in life. And even God, you know, God is always dumping this stuff on me. And there is this blaming that goes on. All of these patterns are used in a variety of ways to handle negative feelings and a negative view of ourselves. But it is the assumption of the recovery program of AA, something that is articulated very, very well in John Keller's book, that the real heart of the issue is spiritual. It is not even physical or emotional or psychological. The real issue, the key to the whole business, is spiritual. What is at stake is the fundamental assumptions that we make about ourselves. And the fundamental set of assumptions we make about what life is supposed to be like. And therefore, these very basic assumptions are assumptions of the human spirit. They are religious assumptions in the broad sense of the word religion. It doesn't matter whether people are going to church or not. But in terms of the way in which we actually live out our lives, the pattern of life that shapes us, the set of assumptions that are important to define how life operates and what we are to expect, these assumptions are our religious or spiritual assumptions. And that's precisely what is at stake in the dynamics of chemical dependency and indeed in the dynamics of personal and interpersonal behavior and interaction. And so there is something very strange and interesting going on here. People who are chemically dependent, who look to alcohol or other drugs to help them deal with negative feelings and negative experiences in life and negative assumptions about themselves, end up in patterns of behavior and in consequences of that addiction to alcohol and drugs that is very, very negative. They use the chemical to escape pain. But the results of using the chemical are such, it only increases the amount of pain. It may be different kinds of pain, but the pain gets increased. They feel more and more criticism from other people. They feel less and less self-respect. They feel more and more guilty. They feel more and more inadequate. They even get into such negative behavior patterns and consequences from their addiction that their marriages start to fall apart, their family life starts to fall apart, their involvement in work begins to become jeopardized. They may in fact lose their jobs because they're not showing up on time and so forth and so on because they're hungover. They're feeling financial strain because of the amount of money it's costing. In the region of illegal drug usage, people have to try and get money to support the habit. They don't have, like, especially, say, teenage kids, they don't have that source of income. Therefore, what are they going to do to get the income? Next thing you know, they start turning to patterns of behavior that will give them the money, but end up having them hate themselves. They're involved in prostitution, they're involved in stealing, they're involved in all sorts of things, which really is heaping up on them terrible feelings that are negative feelings and negative self-image, so that the pain they feel is so intense. Now what happens is, now let me speak as if I were someone who is recovering. Someone who is recovering from drug dependency can stand up in public, and I've heard these people say, "Thank God I'm an alcoholic. Thank God I suffer from this terrible disease." Now, that is an incredible thing to say. But they are persons who are deeply involved in recovery. And why they're saying that is, they have felt such terrible pain in their life that they realized that the pattern they were in was an absolutely dead-end pattern. I mean, literally dead end, because this disease is ultimately a fatal disease. It's a chronic, degenerative, fatal disease. The pattern was so destructive, it was so negative, they finally had to turn outside of themselves for help. Or else they had someone break into the pattern by way of intervention and confront them, and in the confrontation they realized they had to get help. And that help rested outside of themselves. They did not have the capacity within themselves to cope. They did not have the capacity to deal with the disease. They were trapped. They were helpless. And yet, in the midst of this helplessness, the disease was destroying them. How then could they get any kind of help? It was only when they recognized this and admitted that they were powerless and that their lives had become unmanageable, destructive, and negative, and that they came to believe, and this is paraphrasing the steps, the first few steps of the 12-step program, they came to believe that there was a power greater than themselves, something beyond them, that was beneficial and beneficent, that was capable of helping them and liberating them from the power of this self-destructive and other destructive pattern of life, that then they came to recognize both their helplessness and their inadequacy and the possibility of a power greater than themselves, that then they made a conscious decision to surrender, to give up, to stop trying to run their lives and handle their disease. And it was precisely at the point that they gave up control, the assumptions that they could control this, that then recovery began to happen. Now that's the interesting thing. Recovery began to happen for them when they gave up their assumptions that they were in charge of their lives, that they were adequate, and that they could handle their problems. It's when they realized, because of the incredible negativity of the problem that they live with, they realized they couldn't handle it, they couldn't control it, that then they surrendered. And at that point, that's when recovery started. So that's why they say, thank God I'm an alcoholic. Why? Not because they don't have this history of terrible negative behavior and interrelationships and negative view of themselves, all the self-destruction. No, they see a path of liberation and healing opening up for them, and they realize that this is a liberation and healing that applies not just to their alcoholism, but to their being a human being. It applies to everything. It applies to the whole of life. And what is true is it applies to every human life. And in the lives of most of us, we don't suffer that much in life with that much negativity, that much sense of helplessness, that much sense of being trapped to the point that we are willing genuinely to surrender. And therefore, the rest of us tend to move through life believing that we really do control our lives and that we really can handle things and that we really can manage quite well. And we live in that self-deception and that illusion, that grandiosity. And the results are we are trapped in self-destructive patterns and mutually destructive patterns without realizing it and without finding a powerful path out of it. The alcoholic can say, I thank God I'm an alcoholic because my situation became so bad, it was so negative, that finally I had to realize something very basic, more basic than my disease of alcoholism. Has to do with how I see myself as a person. I had to recognize that I do not have control over life. I can have control only over limited realities. I can control and make choices in all sorts of ways. I can especially control my attitude. I mean, my attitude and outlook toward life is always up to me, regardless of what other people are feeling or how they're looking at me or how they're treating me. I always have the capacity to see myself on my own terms and to handle my reactions and to deal with my own basic attitudes. There I do have control. And certainly I have control over the various sorts of choices I make, but at certain basic levels I do not have any choice. And that's what it means to be human. That we have to admit in a radical way that we operate with an illusion that we are in control, and that life revolves around me. That's the basic human problem. We all operate with the assumption that life revolves around me and my needs and my wishes and my wants and my plans and my interests. So here we sit in this room together, and there's a certain kind of operating assumption. We all literally, visually, see the room and everyone in it from the standpoint of where we're sitting and how we're looking around. That's how we visually see. But psychologically and spiritually, it's the same. We deal with what is going on here. We deal with these few minutes together in terms of me and my agenda, my assumptions, my personality, my world. We're always egocentric. We're always involved in this self-centered orientation of always seeing situations from the standpoint of our interests and our own needs. Now, in this regard, what AA recognizes is that this is the basic problem. The basic problem is, on the one hand, we will not accept our radical limits. And on the other hand, we will not accept the real responsibility that we have. That at rock bottom, each one of us as human beings is a carefully, rather complexly disguised infant. There is in each one of us, to the day we die, a squalling brat. There's a little brat inside of each one of us that wakes up in the morning and somehow assumes that the whole of the universe revolves around me, and the whole of life is designed to meet my needs. And the place that this assumption shows up is very, very interesting and can be recognized very quickly. Notice how easily we fall into self-pity. We feel sorry for ourselves. And very often we feel sorry for ourselves. Why? Because things are not going our way. Right? And therefore we become very self-pitying. Oh, poor me. Poor me. Poor little me. Also note our impatience and our low tolerance level when it comes to frustration. We get so impatient and frustrated. Why? Because things are not going our way. The situation is not living up to our expectations, our anticipations, and our assumptions. And therefore, we feel frustrated. John Keller, in his book, points out the incredible grandiosity of this. I mean, how grandiose, how imperial this little brat is inside of each one of us by laughing at himself, which is a healthy sign. When we get to the point of recognizing this, we're able to laugh, it means we're beginning, by God's grace, to get some distance from it. But he said he can remember driving in traffic, and he wanted to get someplace. Notice that. He had his agenda. Well, it was very important. He had this important meeting. So, I mean, yes, it's important. But it's important to whom? To him and to the other people in the meeting, and maybe a few other people that get affected by the decisions that are made at the meeting. But in terms of the universal cosmic scheme of things, how important is it, see? In terms of the operation of the North American continent, how important is the meeting? Right? So he has this crucial meeting to get to. And he says usually he's pretty good in thick, heavy traffic, you know, and he was managing fairly well. But he was feeling more and more pressure, wanting to get to that meeting, And lo and behold, what happened? There were people holding him up. Notice how I'm saying it. People were holding, I'll speak as if I'm John Kelly. People were holding me up. As if it was almost a conspiracy, as if consciously they were making these choices to get in his way. See? And just as he thought he would make a break for it and the traffic lanes were going to open up, he had to pass across a railroad passing, see? A railroad crossing. And darn if the gates didn't come down. And there was the train going past. And he was just furious. He was absolutely fit to be tied. This damn train getting in my way. And then he realized what he was thinking. That this train had gotten in his way. And here were these boxcars rolling by. And he realized these boxcars had come from Florida and Arizona, California and Ohio, New Mexico and Canada. I mean, they were from all over the North American continent. They had all linked themselves up together in a chain. And now we're purposely interfering with him and his life. I mean, how ridiculous the whole thing is. But we're all like that, isn't it? Isn't that true? We have plans, we have expectations, we have needs, we have wants, and the world doesn't go our way. And we feel frustrated and angry and impatient and self-pitying. And so we say things like, why me? Why me? And of course, a very valid answer is, why not you? Why not me? Again, to illustrate from this very helpful and insightful book. John Keller was with someone else, and they were in a nursing home and dealing with the debilitation of what had been very healthy, vigorous, active, productive human beings. And there was a feeling of almost despair at times in seeing how some people physically had degenerated. And Keller said to this other person, we ought to look at this very carefully, because someday this will be us. And the other person said, well, no, I mean, that's not necessarily, I mean, that doesn't happen to everybody. I mean, we don't all end up our older years like this. Notice what the other person was doing? Well, this couldn't be me. See? And Keller was saying, in effect, why couldn't it be you? Why couldn't it be me? Why should we be insulated from the limits and the frustrations and the pain of being human? Because we're finite creatures. We're limited human beings. That's the way we're created. We're created with limits. Did you choose your parents? Sit around in some cosmic cloud somewhere and say, I think I'll decide to get born. It's a wonderful idea. I mean, you know, it sounds like a good idea to me. So yes, I'll be born, and I'm going to pick these parents over here. Did you have any choice about the matter? Did you have any choice about being born? You didn't choose a thing. And yet, splat, here you are. And here we are in this world, and not having any control. That's the point. Having absolutely no control over the fact that we were born. And having absolutely no control over the fact that inevitably we will die. I mean, radically, no control at the beginning or at the end. But in the middle, we keep operating with the assumption that we have all the control in the world. I mean, this is insane. This is an insane way of looking at life. But that's the way we all look at it. That's the little emperor and empress inside of each one of us. That's the grandiosity, you see? So the focus is always on me. My world, my history, my needs, my plans, my hopes, my expectations, my life. And this even shows up when we think we're being generous, noble, self-sacrificing, and self-critical. Self-criticism. Sometimes the character of our self-criticism is such, it is highly grandiose. Member of my family wallpapered her kitchen. Very nice job. Big kitchen, had done an interesting motif. Walked in and I said, oh, this is just beautiful, Cindy. This is just wonderful. She said, yes, but you see up there in the corner, I didn't quite get the pieces matched up right. And of course, I hadn't seen it at all. And now I looked up into the corner of the kitchen, and there I could see how the wallpaper was mismatched. Now, what's going on there? Well, I didn't do it perfectly. Well, of course not. Who do you think you are? Who do we think we are? You see? The expectations we have of ourselves are unrealistic and unhealthy. It's the little emperor and the little empress in disguise again. Or, as I already illustrated, we run around doing good to other people and helping them. Why? In order to handle our own negative feelings about ourselves. So very often our quote-unquote generosity really is a form of self-affirmation and self-seeking. And at the same time we don't accept our limits, we don't accept our freedom, our real responsibility within those limits. That within those limits we are responsible for what we do with life and the attitudes we take and the choices we make and so forth. Now all of this comes to a head for people who are suffering from the disease of chemical dependency because they have tried every trick in the book to handle themselves and to control their usage. There is not a person that goes through treatment who hasn't tried in one way or another to control the use. And people have made promises to other people. You know, the negative effects of drinking are such that there's a confrontation and a conflict, and the person says, I'll never touch another drop again. And they mean it. That's the difficult thing to believe, but it's true. They mean it, but they can't live up to it. And then they're filled with self-hatred and despair and guilt and isolation. And all those negative feelings, so how do they handle the negative feelings? They go out and drink even more, see? That's the dynamic of the thing. So they cannot control the disease. And they try. They cannot heal themselves. They cannot make themselves whole. They cannot get rid of the negative feelings and make them disappear. They don't know how to handle them. And the result is that they fall, get deeper and deeper into the disease until the effects are very, very negative and very destructive. And it is then that they learn the only way to handle the disease is radical surrender. Radical surrender. To give up those egocentric assumptions and illusions, and recognize that they live in a world that they did not construct and over which they do not have total control, in fact, very little control at certain points, and they must learn to live with that limited life one day at a time, to use another AA slogan. One day at a time. They have to accept life from the hands of God, and they have to lean on a strength greater than their own, and they have to be willing to surrender their ego. And so the recovery program is not just simply withdrawing from the use of the drugs physically, or even just learning to recognize and handle negative feelings, but it is to have a radical re-understanding of oneself. and to learn genuine humility. Genuine humility. And therefore to live out that life, a new life, day by day, in which they recognize at the beginning of the day, I have no control over my chemical dependency. It is something given to me, like some people are given diabetes, other people are given multiple sclerosis, other people are given cerebral palsy. I have no control over it. And therefore, I must learn to accept that limitation and live within it. It means, therefore, I have to admit my helplessness, and I have to lean upon a power greater than myself. I have to lean upon the power and the presence of God. And what I do just for today, I'm not dealing with the rest of my life, I'm dealing just with today. Today, I turn my chemical dependency over to God and I say, today, this is your problem, and I place it in your hands, and I am not going to try to exercise control over it, but I will surrender, and I will lean upon you this day, and I will not lean upon myself. And on that basis, they live out that day. So in the morning, there is surrender, and at the end of the day, there is thanks for the affirmation and the support and the health and the comfort that God has given them for that day. That's part of the dynamics of that recovery program. But what is interesting about it is that at its very heart, it really is applicable to every life. And as you can already sense, it is totally coherent with the gospel of Jesus Christ. To accept the world in its delimitation, accept the world in all of its limits and its negativity, to recognize that we do not have any ultimate control. Remember Jesus struggling in the Garden of Gethsemane? And surrendering and trusting the grace of God and leaning upon that one day at a time and being very intentional about it for that one day. And out of that comes health and renewal. And out of it also comes some of the most wonderful, life-loving, humor-filled human beings I have ever encountered. If ever you want to see a wonderful group of people, go to an open AA meeting. And the key to it is they laugh at themselves. They laugh at themselves. Because they're laughing at the little emperor and the little empress inside of each one of them. And out of that comes a kind of freedom that enables them to live more creatively and more courageously than they had in the past. And they have before them a program of growth. And the same holds true for codependents, those who are dysfunctionally affected by the behavior of chemically dependent people, spouses, parents, children, siblings. When they recognize they too are caught up in negative patterns and they realize how helpless they are, they have no control over the alcoholic anymore than the alcoholic has control over the alcohol. They do not have control. And that is an insight we all need to learn. We do not have any ultimate control over one another. We just don't. You can stand on your head and spit nickels. You can do everything you can to control and manipulate your kids. You're either going to end up with kids that are going to subvertly go their own way, or you're going to end up with little automatons that never become full human beings. But to deal with another human being as a human being, you must recognize, first of all, you do not have any control. None. And that is terrifying. And I've heard parents of chemically dependent kids talk about the agony that they suffer in knowing their kid is chemically dependent. They've tried everything in the book. You name it, they've tried it. And society is always blaming them. The reason the kid is out of control, the reason the kid is in trouble with drugs or something like that, is because they haven't had the right upbringing at home. And here are parents who have tried everything and have tried counselors. They've done everything that you can think of. And yet the kid is still in trouble with drugs. And yet they haven't learned that the kid has a disease yet. And they're exhausted and worn down. And then they discover the dynamics of this disease, and they come to realize, I do not have any ultimate control over my child. And to let that child go and to turn them over into the hands of God is a terrifying thing to do, because you don't know what these kids might do to themselves, including suicide. Almost all teenage suicides are the result of chemical dependency. It's a very risky way to live, at a point of recognizing the truth of the matter. One does not have control, and be willing at that point to turn it over to, as the book, the title of the book echoes from an AA slogan, to let go of this other person and let God pick up the pieces of that life, even if the pieces are tragic ones. Well, perhaps I've talked enough at this point, and let me open up now to some questions, but perhaps you can begin to see that the genius of the AA recovery program and the parallel recovery programs like Al-Anon for the codependent family members, or Al-Ateen for teenagers, Al-Atats for children of alcoholics, Families Anonymous for the parents of chemically dependent children, and other parallel programs like Parents Anonymous for parents who are physically abusing their children, and so forth and so on. These programs all operate with the same pattern of recovery and the same 12-step program. And I think that what I find is that from a Christian point of view, the standpoint of Christian tradition and insight and spirituality, that it is very powerfully coherent and very illuminating for all of us. And I think we all can benefit by that 12-step program in seeing it as an expression of what our own Christian discipleship entails. Okay, end of my comments.
Just an observation that I find it really fascinating that when you come to the end, you come out with true humility. And near the beginning, where we first discover we're in trouble, we somehow manage to convince ourselves we are humble. We don't like ourselves, and therefore we are humble. And it's just an interesting way that we do that interior argument before we can come out with true humility.
Yes, I thank you very much for that, Walt. I think that's right. We have to distinguish between true humility and not liking ourselves or putting ourselves down, because that, in a way, is a part of the unhealth in us, because we have an unrealistic understanding and vision of ourselves. We're not dealing with ourselves realistically. I mean, that we've been given the gift of life itself shows that we matter. Just that. But that we expect so much of ourselves, or we buy into the expectations of other people that we're supposed to do everything and be everything. And so, you know, it's kind of amusing to think about it. You know, no matter what you do, I could say, but you still don't paint like Rembrandt yet. You still don't cook like Julia Childs.
How do you find that balance, though, between recognizing your limitations on the one hand, and on the other hand, though maybe not going as far as you're able?
Well, I think the question is, how can you tell the balance between where are your real limitations and where are you just not reaching your full potential? I think it has to do with the effects of what's going on. If the effects are themselves negative, if you're putting yourself down, if you really are generating lots of negative feelings about yourself, if the effects of your behavior are hurting other people. There are some people who are almost, you know, they're obsessive about something to the point of neglecting their families, their friendships. There's something very wrong about that. And I know that our world admires people who are so quote-unquote dedicated, but I think if you look at it carefully, it's a very unhealthy pattern of life. You know, because you're really losing out the richness of interconnection with other human beings, for example. So that would be it. Or in the case of, you know, chemical dependency or any other disorder, it's obviously a point where you want control over something and you don't have the control. you discover you don't have it. You don't have, people keep saying, but you've got to get the willpower, and you discover you try, but it doesn't work. So one of the other slogans that I've heard that has come out of the 12-step recovery program is, try softer. Instead of try harder, try softer. Ah, yes. Your problem is not that you believe in God, don't believe in God, but that you do believe that you are God. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, see, that it's that grandiosity, it's the assumption, that little emperor, that little empress inside each one of us, that infant. And from the standpoint of the Christian tradition, that's something of what quote-unquote original sin is about. It's not something you get learn. You learn. It's something that somehow is innately there. Is there this egocentricity which somehow never lets go. That a baby screams for milk when it's so helpless. One can understand that. I mean, and maybe that's part of it. Talk about radical dependency. In our earliest years, we were so radically dependent on everything outside of us. But that never gets abandoned, and we keep somewhere there is that little core of an unrealistic, unhealthy ego that will not accept real limits and will not accept real responsibility and the health of finding that, and how that the disease of alcoholism, chemical dependency, becomes the occasion for those who enter into recovery then to begin to get at something even deeper than their disease. And that's why, as I said, the paradox, the irony of people getting up publicly and saying, thank God I'm an alcoholic. If it wasn't for this, I never would have had this fundamental confrontation with myself and enter into a recovery that is really healing me at such a profound level and touches the whole of my life, not just my allergic response to this particular chemical.
I'd just like to share, because if possible, to ask this probably good, but I am one of the chemically dependent people. Lots of questions. But I, and one of the reasons I wanted to come to this, without getting into a long story, is with the spiritual issue in God, and God as we understand Him, as a Christian, and is revealed in Scripture. And I've had a lot of trouble with that in the program. Not the program is written in terms of what it's saying and practicing, but in that fellowshipping part of it. Because I went through a treatment center in the beginning, it was almost 8 years ago, and unbeknownst to me, it was an EST-controlled treatment center in a public hospital. And that produced some emotional responses and weak condition, fighting and defending my faith and maybe really knowing that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been, I guess you would call it part of my denial system, very, very tender scar tissue. Mm-hmm. When we start talking about God,
mm-hmm.
I want to have the company and fellowship of Christians.
Yes.
In that context.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result in that area, being in conscious prayer, as you may be aware, there's a heavy influence of the meism, faith religion, and in that extends into that chemically dependent community. And so I'll find myself in a meeting as a compulsive dependent person and may even be bold enough to make mention of my reliance upon faith. And then immediate defensive mechanisms begin, and 3 or 4 people will stand up and rebuke the church and rebuke the faith. But the God is AA, if you want. And I find that, for me, personally, very difficult as a mind that can be people can influence a lot of annoying. As fellowship, I find for my own personal recovery.
Yeah.
And so I seek out and look for support within the Christian community.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes very difficult.
Yes.
Very difficult. I was interested in your seminary thing in terms of support that you provide in the seminary. How can we get this going in the church?
That it's a long, hard struggle.
To do this on my own.
Yeah.
Even my study of theology with it, even my this very thing of letting go and letting God. It is very difficult. Hard. And I've had slips with that. I'm not going to blame on that, but it is a fact, the sense of aloneness, even within the church community.
Yes, and the understanding of the dynamics of chemical dependency are not very well known except for people who are affected by it. And that's where I think that the church has a responsibility and opportunity to try and let people understand that and to create a community of support and caring and openness and acceptance and affirmation and support. And this is just beginning, but I think that here and there you find some good strides being made. If I were you, I would shop around in the San Francisco area. I would bet that somewhere there are some congregations where there are large numbers of recovering people that you could tap into who have coordinated and integrated their Christian identity and Christian faith and their recovery in the AA program. There you would be able to find people who understand the AA program, and you have connection and community with them, and at the same time, they are reaffirming and reappropriating their Christian faith. I must say that in terms of people in AA who are critical of the church, it makes me, I'll sneak up on it by repeating something George Buttrick used to say when he was chaplain at Harvard College. He'd end up having these young students come in who had sort of undergone the rite of passage of the first year of college training, and they would say, Mr. Buttrick, I don't believe in God anymore. And his response always used to be, tell me the kind of God you don't believe in, and maybe I don't believe in that God either. And I think that that is often the case. The kind of religion, you see, that's being rejected is very neurotic religion, or destructive, or negative, or legalistic religion. And I have all the sympathy in the world with these people's criticisms. And that's where I don't endorse religion in and of itself. I think it's important to recognize that religion has been the source of a lot of harm. It wasn't the local atheist society that got Jesus crucified. And it's been true like that through history. Martin Luther understood very clearly the place where sin always hides out the longest is in the middle of morality and religion, because that's where it disguises itself as its opposite. But that's where sin is most embedded, deeply embedded. Human neuroticism, human inhumanity, human self-hatred, human prejudice, all of these things.
Could you say that just one more time? It's in the religion?
Well, religion and morality are the places where sin hides out the longest and where it's most deeply embedded, because there it's disguised as its opposite. See? That's the truly demonic. St. Paul warns us, beware of Satan disguised as the angel of light. Satan seen as something satanic or demonic, that's bad enough. But the really satanic, destructive stuff is when it looks like it's the angelic, when it's the holy and the sacred. And so look at the fanaticism that's around. Look at the hatred of other people because they don't fit into your particular group. Look at the kind of gods that people believe in that are inhumane. You know, I'll give you an example. Some Christian types say something about, well, if you're not a Christian, you're damned to hell forever, you know. And I say, well, what about all these Buddhists, you know, that you can bump up against if you do a little traveling? You're going to damn them to hell too? I said, well, I'm sorry, they're very wonderful people and very spiritual and all that, but, you know, if they don't accept Jesus as their personal Lord and Savior, God's going to damn them to hell. To which I respond, in that case, I want to be damned to hell too, because I'd rather be with these Buddhists, because at the heart of the Buddhist, one of the Buddhist traditions anyway, is the tradition of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva is a person who has reached a stage of spiritual wholeness and is ready to enter into the fullness of Nirvana, but looks back at the world and sees the suffering and pain of humanity and chooses, in the Buddhist tradition anyway, to be reborn and enter the pain and suffering in the world in order to alleviate it. So I said, send me to hell with all these Buddhists because they'll become bodhisattvas and will transform hell into paradise. See? So, what kind of God don't you believe in? What kind of religion are you rejecting? Don't assume it's all of one cloth or it's all of one piece. And that's where, as I guess I mentioned a couple of weeks ago here, when I hear people say that they believe in God, I'm not impressed. I'm more interested in what kind of a God they believe in or what kind of a functional religion they have that really runs their life. And the same way when I hear people say, I don't believe in God, that doesn't interest me either because I want to find out what the real operating deities of their life are. What are the things that really they commit themselves to most deeply, that they care about most deeply, that they hope in most ultimately? Those sorts of things are really the equivalent of what is God for them. And this is what Luther says in the Large Catechism in the explanation of the first commandment. A person's God is that in which that to which you look for all the good in your life and in which you put your deepest trust. That's your real God. That's what I'm interested in. See? So that can help, I think, clarify some of this. And some of these people have had a lot of negative experience in the church, and I can't blame them for their reaction. Radical surrender that spells itself out in humility, in radical trust, in radical hope toward an uncharted future, and in discipleship. Yes, that's where I think Christians can pick this up in their own, from the standpoint of their own tradition, and find at the heart of our tradition resonances that are very coherent with this recovery program. And so I think that's where Christians in the recovery program can reappropriate the real meaning of the foundations and substance of the faith. Yeah.
And that's a good way then to open up and ask and get the conversation going. It's not a threatening question anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
When the final word on your outline is surrender, but we've talked a lot about what it is you surrender to, something outside yourself, name it God. If it is not a something outside yourself known through Jesus the Christ, it might still, the Jewish faith, somebody commented on, it might still be that something outside the self, which is the ground of all life.
Mm-hmm.
And goodness.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be grace, not known through Jesus Christ, but known.
Yes, I agree.
I
have no problems with that.
AA is not a Christian organization.
No, it is not a Christian organization.
But yet there is the grace toward which the cross of Christ points.
That's right.
Is experienced as being there in that act.
Yes, see, and that's where I affirm that as a Christian, because we say that Jesus is for us God's living Word made flesh, dwelling among us, full of grace and truth. But this Word, this self-expression of God, is that which accounts for the whole universe, so that in some way or other, the whole universe is an arena within which God's self-communication and God's self-expression is present. And therefore, something of the resonances of what we see in and through Jesus are encountered all over the place. And this is God in God's self-expression. This is God's logos. This is the second person of the Trinity. So I'm not surprised to find it outside of the church. I mean, if God were restricted to the Christian church, what a tin horn deity that would be, you know? And a quote that I've used around here a couple of times, St. Augustine once said, there is much that belongs to Christ that is found outside of the church, just as there is much that does not belong to Christ that is found within the church. Okay. So it's Jesus as the model of what this is really happening. And in terms of those who turn to AA and see that as the higher power, the point is that AA is based on a wisdom, an insight into the way in which life operates. It's not something that people just make up as they go along and can change the day after tomorrow. It's insight into the coherences of how life is constructed. Therefore, ultimately, it rests on the way in which life comes to us. And from a Christian point of view, that's part of what we mean by the term God. So they may not see it because they're rejecting a particular notion of God. But in fact, ultimately, they are leaning on a wisdom and a power and a pattern of things greater than themselves. And as I would say, as a Christian, I would say that indeed is God.